You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
Welcome to the Horses Equine Innovators Podcast, sponsored by Zoetis. I'm your host, Stephanie Church, editorial director at thehorseandthehorse.com. Every day, researchers at universities and other institutions around the world are examining new ways to care for and understand our horses. In this podcast series, we talk to those innovators to learn more about their work. Today, we're taking a closer look at a challenge every horse owner and vet must manage: internal parasites. For decades, horse owners relied on routine rotational deworming to manage those parasites. But times and parasites have changed. With drug resistance on the rise in these populations, scientists now emphasize targeted strategic control of these parasites. Joining us today is Dr. Martin Nielsen, professor of equine clinical sciences at Aarhus University in Denmark. Dr. Nielsen has led many of the studies guiding modern parasite control in horses. In this episode, we'll discuss what we're up against, how current tools work, and what smarter parasite management looks like, both now and in the years ahead. Welcome, Dr. Nielsen.
Thank you very much.
Excited to have you today. So let's start with the big picture of parasite control. How has our understanding of equine internal parasites evolved over the past, say, two decades?
Yeah, I think the biggest sort of change is how we think about the parasites. And I think that we used to think about them as organisms that we could eliminate and that we didn't want, and that the whole goal was elimination of these parasites. I don't want parasites in my horse. I don't want my horse to have worms. How do I get rid of them? And it wasn't just in horses, that was across the board. That was in all the domestic animals, that parasites were unwanted creatures, and then we could get rid of them. We had the chemical dewormers, the medications that, you know, by the 1980s had become really, really excellent and really effective and safe, and were used widely and frequently. And so that was the goal at the time. And that's how I grew up, for example. And now our, you know, approach is more like living with the parasites, accepting that they're there and that they're normal inhabitants of the intestinal tract of our animals, and that we can't eliminate them. And we've tried that for too long, and we've only gotten a lot of trouble out of that. So we still talk about parasite control, how to manage parasite infections in our animals, how to minimize the risk of disease caused by the parasites, which is the goal of our parasite control programs. But we don't talk about how to get rid of parasites, how to eliminate parasites, because we can't. And that's the message that we're trying to bring across.
Okay, thank you. So for years as a horse owner, my mom and I can remember we did rotational deworming every 6 to 8 weeks with a different product. But today we know that approach helped fuel resistance in these parasites that we need to manage. Can you walk us through how and why the strategy had to change?
Yeah, so that strategy, which I think if we're sort of old enough, we're all familiar with that approach of deworming relatively frequently, kind of calendar-based, where, you know, we would go, oh, the first of every other month or whatnot, we should deworm our animals, and you just put a mark in the calendar, and then you treat all the horses with the same product. And with that was also this, oh, if we rotate, we use a different dewormer every time, we won't get any drug resistance problems. So that was the recommendation when I grew up on my parents' horse farm, and that's what we were told, right? That was the state of the art at the time. Mm-hmm. Now, that's, you know, what we know now is that, first of all, that's a very frequent and unnecessary treatment regimen, that there really aren't any horses anywhere in the world that need to be dewormed that often, that horses are different and so are the parasites, that you can't just treat them all the same. different dewormers work differently against different parasites, and you need to know what you're treating before you can make the right choice. And then some horses get many parasites, most of them get very few, and we need to get that knowledge and find out which are the, you know, the high shedders of parasite eggs and which ones are not. And so this, you know, it becomes more complex because it's biology, and biology is complex, and it is not as simple as maybe we would like it to be. But the biggest problem with that approach is that if you don't check if it even works, you might have been living on a false sense of security for a very long time, just assuming that if I do this, if I follow this schedule, this regimen, then I have good parasite control. You don't know if you're not testing. And that is another main message that we have today. If you haven't tested the efficacy of the dewormers that you're using yet, now is a very good time to start, because there's no way that you could know whether it works or not. And then I know of many, many horse owners that have this, shall we say, hobby of checking the poop for worms after deworming to see what's coming out. And then they kind of base their conclusions about the efficacy on what they see. Now, there's a couple of problems with that. First of all, the worms that don't get killed by the dewormer, they stay inside the horse, right? So you don't see them. You don't know what stays inside. Just because you see some worms coming out,
yes,
doesn't really tell you whether, you know, there might have been other worms that stayed inside the horse and survived the treatment. And then also, you only see the larger parasites, the ones that are visible to the naked eye. And the majority of the worms that horses get are actually very, very small. And you need microscope and magnification and washing and sieving, which is a lot of work. We've done it. My students, I should say, have done that a lot in my lab. Before that can be considered a reliable method. So just this, like, you know, poking in a pile of poop with a stick and going, oh, yep, no worms. It's not a useful diagnostic test. It really isn't. So you can't really conclude much from that other than the fact that, oh, there's a bot, and oh, that might be an ascrid parasite or whatever.
Right.
But that's the extent of what you really learn from that exercise. So yeah, we don't know how it works or if it even works if we don't test.
Exactly. Okay, thank you. And we'll start talking about some more about testing a little later on in our conversation. And I'm excited to get the specifics on how we should do it. So what do you now consider the main parasite of concern in adult horses and why? I know that's changed a little over the years.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think in the U.S., it is tapeworms that are the main concern in adult horses. Yeah. Tapeworms are documented to be the cause of some specific types of colic that are related to that junction between the small and large intestine, right, where the small intestine attaches to the large intestine. That's where we have the cecum, and that's right where the tapeworms like to hang out, and that's where they cause some specific kinds of colic that are pretty well described. It can be an impaction of worms in that last part of the small intestine called the ileum, or we sometimes also see what we call an intussusception, which is sort of a telescoping of that piece of small intestine that kind of pumps itself into the cecum, and it sometimes gets stuck when it does that. Right. And then that can require surgery. So those are some specific types of colic. It doesn't happen in every horse that gets tapeworms. Far from it. I mean, most horses tolerate tapeworms extremely well. But if you were to sort of rank the parasite with the most clinical or health impact amongst adult horses, it's tapeworms today. Now, the other parasite that we talk about in adult horses are the small strongyle, which are the ones that we typically find, and the one that really all horses have. And when we have egg counts done, that those are the eggs that we are most likely to find, the strongyle eggs. Now, pretty much all horses have these, but they really, really extremely rarely cause any kind of health issue in North America. It is different in other countries. And so you have readers and listeners that are not in North America. And so if you are in the United Kingdom, for example, the situation is different there. They do see health issues associated with small strong jowls that we in America tend to not see. I am now, as you said, in Denmark. In Denmark, we also see health issues associated with small strong jowls. Not very often, but from time to time. And so the sort of ranking of which parasite category is the most important depends on location. And why is that? You may wonder, we don't know. We speculate that maybe it has to do with climatic conditions, but perhaps that's a hypothesis. And now it doesn't really explain the entire continent of North America because there are lots of different climates there, right? And horses in many different climate types. So that can't explain it alone. Well, maybe we'll find out eventually why that is. It's an interesting question. So, and then in some parts of the world, there's also still large strong jowls, particularly bloodworms, and especially like here in Scandinavia, where I'm right now, that's still an important parasite. In North America, for the most part, certainly in the U.S., that parasite is very rare and is not very often encountered. So that is not one that makes it to the top of the list. So again, it depends on where you are. So, but in the U.S., it's the tapeworms.
Okay.
That's the answer. Yeah.
Right. So you mentioned adult horses. What about the young horses? I know we often hear about ascarids in the young horses. What's unique about that particular worm's life cycle and why do they require a different approach?
Yeah, so the ascarids or large roundworms, as some people refer to them as.
The same thing. Okay.
Or parascaris, the Latin name there. You know, it's a unique parasite in a number of different ways. First of all, its occurrence seems to be very much defined by the age of the animal. So you can sort of look at, okay, how old is this animal? And then from that, you can say, well, this one is unlikely to have ascarids, or it could have some ascarids, depending on its age. So the typical age range is from a couple of weeks of life until about 6 months. That's the ascarid era. That's where foals have ascarids. The worm burdens tend to peak at about 4 to 5 months of age, and then worms just disappear regardless of what we do, actually. So whether we deworm those foals or not, those worms are going to disappear, and that's because of the immune response to the parasites. So this is a parasite that sort of comes in early on, and it's there in early life, and then it disappears. And typically, usually, adult horses don't have ascarids, although there are exceptions. And some of the listeners may have actually maybe had a horse or heard of a horse that had an adult horse that had ascarids. So it can occur, but it's like the one oddball here and one oddball there. Sometimes brood mares can have a few ascarid eggs in their fecal sample because they're in an environment with lots and lots of ascarids because they have the foals all around them all the time and the foals are shedding ascarid eggs. So sometimes we see that, but also I would say very rarely. I've examined a lot of fecal samples from a lot of brood mares in central Kentucky and really, really not found ascarids at all, or extremely rarely at least. So it's not something that happens very frequently. But every now and then, people contact me about an adult horse that they have that just keeps having ascarids. Mm-hmm. And when doesn't seem to really help to deworm them, they just keep shedding ascarid eggs, and sometimes worms come out, and it feels like there's nothing that they can really do to effectively treat those horses. And most often, those horses are not affected by the worms, but of course there are concerns that maybe this is a potential risk to that horse. And the big question there is like, why? Why does this horse keep getting ascarids? And we don't know. We don't know. All we can say is that normally it's the immune system that kicks those worms out at about 6 months of age or so, 6 to 8 months of age, and that's where it's happening. And so why that's not happening in this particular horse, we don't know. We can guess, we can speculate whether there's like some immune dysfunction or something that didn't manage to kick those worms out. So that does happen, but very rarely. And then the other thing about the parasites, the ascrids, is that they have this unique migration inside the horse. So they go on this journey where they migrate through the liver and then to the lungs, and then they get coughed up and then swallowed a second time. And finally, they take residence in the small intestine. And so there has been some descriptions of respiratory manifestations, coughing, snotty nose, associated with these migrations of these parasites. Now, it doesn't appear to be, that parasite doesn't appear to be the main cause of airway issues in young foals, though. I think there are viruses and bacteria around that these foals are also exposed to. So it doesn't appear to be a main cause of respiratory problems, although it can cause it. But most of the time, the foals don't have any clinical manifestations of these migrations. But then the parasites arrive in the intestinal tract and they live in the small intestine, and they are the largest parasites that horses can get. And they can get very big, and then just mechanically they can clog the small intestine and cause an intestinal impaction. And just simply consisting of a clog of worms that are blocking the intestinal tract, and that causes colic. Many listeners will be familiar with impactions. There's a difference between impactions in the small intestine and impactions in the large intestine, which is the kind of impaction that probably most of the listeners have experienced, that the kind of colic where if you walk the horse, sometimes it recovers, you know, you want it to get to poop and then it poops that impaction out and then it's fine afterwards. That's a large intestinal impaction. It usually is quite benign, not as much of a priority. Whereas a small intestinal impaction is very different. It's very painful, especially in these young foals, and surgery can be required. And it's not just a matter of, you know, some fluid and mineral oil or whatever people might pass down the nasogastric tube. It's not how you manage these small intestinal impactions. So they're quite serious and can be life-threatening now. They happen extremely rarely. I mean, when you think of it, most foals, especially on larger farms, are exposed to ascrids during the first months of life. And you know, very, very few of them ever develop any problems. So parasites in general, and you know, they're far from this scenario of, oh, infection equals disease. Far from it. And most of the time, infection is just fine. And like I said in the very beginning, it is the normal state for the horses to have these parasites, and that actually includes the ascaris. So they're there for like a short time. And then at a young age, where animals are susceptible and sometimes can be affected by the parasites.
Okay, thank you.
I should add that the three categories of parasites that we've talked about thus far, so we talked about tapeworms, I mentioned the small strongyles as well, and now we've talked about ascrids. We see multi-drug resistance in all three categories.
Yeah.
And at a very high level, at least in some parts of the world, to the extent where nothing works. So, you know, very importantly, these three parasite categories that can all cause serious disease, it is important that we regularly test for resistance.
Yes.
To these dormers and these parasites.
So I'm jumping ahead a little bit here. Let's just go ahead and talk about some testing for resistance. What does that look like practically for the horse owner, farm manager, and veterinarian?
Yeah, I mean, it's in a way, it's fairly simple. We need two fecal egg counts. And we need one set of fecal egg counts at around the time of deworming, could be on the day before, or thereabout, and then another set of egg counts from the same horses 2 weeks after deworming. And then we look at the percent reduction of those eggs, and we have some thresholds, some guidelines for how to interpret those results, and the veterinarian would have access to that information. And then we can see if we got the reduction that we expected. And there's also guidelines as to how many horses should you ideally test in a test like this. Resistance testing is really, in principle, not an individual horse test. It's not like I'm going to test my horse for resistance and you might want to test your horse also or not. No, we're testing the parasite population that is shared by horses that are kept together, that are grazing together. And so getting more than one horse in the test is better because then you get more, you know, each horse is a sample of that population.
Right.
And then you get more samples of that parasite population, and you can make a more solid inference across multiple horses compared to just testing one. So our recommendation is a minimum of 5 horses that are egg count positive prior to treatment for whatever the parasite is. And then you're the same 5 horses post-treatment. So first of all, if you have more than 5, you don't have to test all the horses present, but if you can get 5, you have a good solid basis for your test. Mm-hmm. Now, sometimes you don't have 5 horses, or you may have 5, but they're not all egg count positive. And what do you do then? And we included some suggestions in the AAEP guidelines. I've been part of writing a lot of different guideline documents in recent years. AAEP guidelines were the first that we wrote, and then we've been writing guidelines for other parts of the country, world, I should say, since then. And I've been involved with many of them. We try to put the same guidance in there so that, you know, we kind of get some consensus between those guidelines. So we did include some suggestions for how to do a test with less than 5 horses, because we think that it still has value to do it, even if you only have 1. It's better to get some test results, but you just sort of need to be a little bit more cautious with the interpretation. But, you know, to put it simply, for example, if you just bought yourself a new horse and you're bringing it to a facility where it's going to be boarded and you want to do maybe a quarantine treatment, so you're going to be testing a single horse. Is that a good idea? Yes, it is. It's a very good idea. You might go ahead and deworm it with a dewormer that is one that they use at that facility anyway, and then you get a fecal egg count at day 0, you keep it in that quarantine paddock or whatever for those 2 weeks, and then you get another egg count. And, you know, there shouldn't be any eggs of any parasite in that post-treatment egg count. And so if you get a 0, that's a good result. That's meaningful. It looked like that dewormer worked. That's good to know for the farm and for the manager of that farm, that operation. Now, if you still have parasite eggs in that sample, you should maybe talk to your veterinarian about, you know, what should we then do, right? Because that is the whole point with doing that test, but that could be meaningful, right? Okay, did it spit out some of that paste? That sometimes happens, right? Did we dose it correctly? What product did we use? Had it been sitting on a shelf in the barn in a hot Kentucky summer for too long, or, you know, those kinds of questions that we always need to double check before we just end up concluding, oh, you know, resistance. We could maybe repeat that treatment. If it is truly resistance, then repeating the treatment, you should get the same result, right? If you all of a sudden get this miraculous reduction to 0 the second time you treat with the same product, then it wasn't resistance. It was something else.
Yeah. You know, some you of these out when you weren't looking.
Yeah, exactly. They're all some of those things. So it's good to do kind of that as a double check. And then if it still looks like you don't get that reduction of those eggs in that sample that you expect, then you could maybe consider treating with a different class of dewormer. Now, we don't have that many different classes to choose between. In that instance, it is worthwhile exploring maybe one of the other classes. So even with a single horse, it can be a meaningful exercise.
Yes.
And we do have some instructions for how to approach that situation in our guidelines.
That's great. Thank you. Because I know at the barn where I board, it's like we have two geldings in one field, four geldings in another, five in another, three mares, so it's not five or more in each large field.
Right.
And so like my previous horse, I remember he would always come back as a low shedder, but there may have been others in the field that had different results.
Right.
So in a scenario like that, when you habitually have a low shedder that comes back or zero shedder, I do know that I've, it's been recommended that we still deworm them a couple times a year, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And can you speak to that and what type of class to use for those types of two times a year deworming, even for the horses that are the low shedders or no shedders?
Yeah. So the shedding status that we kind of usually come to find that our horses tend to sort of stay at approximately the same level like yours did, right? And it was always a low shedder or even a zero egg count horse every time you test it year after year after year. That's a very common scenario that horses tend to sort of stay at the same level of shedding, and they also return to that same level of shedding following deworming. And when we talk about that, that's useful to know, right? Then you know that some horses are shedding more eggs onto the pasture than others, and that's the source of infection. That's what's coming out of those horses and out onto those pastures. And so there's point in maybe targeting some of those higher shedding horses more. And that's why we do these egg counts, is to find out, what's the pattern in this group. Right, where is the high shedder or the couple of high shedders, and maybe those high shedders could need an additional treatment in the year, in the middle of the season, for example, because as I said, it's going to return to that high level of shedding, and it's going to do that, the 4, 5, 6 weeks after that treatment, and then we're well into the grazing season, and maybe there's point and value in treating that horse again, not the whole group. I mean, because the others are likely to be low or zero egg count horses and they don't need that additional treatment, but that high shedding horse, there is point and value in treating that horse. And so that's how we're targeting the treatments. Now, the parasite category that we're targeting with these decisions based on egg counts, that's the small strongyle group that we talked about earlier, that I said, we rarely see disease in North America. In other parts of the world, we see some disease caused by these parasites, but it is really unusual in the United States to see disease. So we can be quite laid back and take this testing approach. Now, there are other parasites to consider that will not be reflected by the parasite egg counts. So once we get past that full age where they can have the ascarids, the ascarid eggs we can also recognize in the fecal sample, and so it's a good tool to monitor this change that we see in the weanlings, that they go from shedding ascarids primarily to now shedding strongyle eggs instead, and the ascarids disappearing, and we can use the fecal egg count to monitor that. But once we get past that point, the egg counts primarily reflect the small strongyles, but there are other parasites that we want to consider. And particularly the large strongyles that I mentioned before, and especially the bloodworm, which is potentially more pathogenic parasite, one that's more capable of causing serious disease. And it's one that we don't want sort of creeping back into the picture, because we're too busy looking at other parasites. And so strategically, if you treat once or twice a year, you keep that parasite at bay. It hasn't developed any drug resistance at this point, at least. And so that's part of the rationale for this foundation of treatments, the baseline treatments that we call them, that should be considered for all or at least most horses. We used to also use that same argument about tapeworm treatment. mm-hmm. that we wanted to include at least something for tapeworms at least once a year to all horses and to kind of get the tapeworms taken care of. However, in recent years, we've seen a lot of drug resistance all of a sudden show up in the tapeworm. So we can't just rely upon a yearly tapeworm treatment or two and then assume that we've got tapeworms under control. So that's concerning. And so I think in future revisions of our guidelines, we'll have to recommend more testing specifically for tapeworms instead of just sort of covering our bases with a treatment to all horses. That might not be adequate anymore. And so the one thing that we tell veterinarians to do is to also look for tapeworms eggs in those fecal samples. We don't see them as often and as much in the samples. They're usually not present in high numbers in any fecal sample, but they're there. And that's actually how we found out about the drug resistance. That was because a veterinarian started noticing tapeworm eggs in the post-treatment samples, the ones taken 2 weeks after deworming in horses. And they got a hold of me and said, hey, Dr. Nilsson, aren't these things supposed to go away when we deworm? And I was like, you know what? Send me a couple samples. It's probably pollen grains that you're looking at. I mean, don't be embarrassed. It's happened before.
Right.
Oh, it's a little like tapeworm eggs. Tapeworm eggs are a little bit irregular looking anyway. And pollen can also look weird. So yeah, it's probably what it is. And then we got the samples and those were tapeworm eggs.
Huh.
Absolutely. And then we got more samples and we started getting samples from different farms and realized that, this is not just, a local problem on one farm. This is pretty much across the board. And so that was discovered and documented by use of fecal egg counts and just regular fecal egg counts, actually. So there is value in doing that for tapeworms as well. And certainly something that we now recommend. And there might be value in, still deworming every horse with a tapeworm dewormer, but maybe try to get some post-treatment samples in from some of those treated horses to see if we find anything. And I think it's the fourth time I already said this in this podcast. You need to test for resistance. You need to test for resistance. And we do that by the fecal egg counts post deworming. So.
Right. So I was going to ask you, what are the biggest mistakes you see horse owners, farm managers, veterinarians still making in their deworming programs today? I know I often see people doing the testing, but maybe not doing the testing after the deworming. Like that's not part of their deal. Is that a mistake that you see? What are some things that you see?
The biggest mistake that I see horse owners and veterinarians make when it comes to parasite control is to not test for resistance.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's as simple as that. And it's assuming that something works or sometimes basing that conclusion on things you really can't base that on. And so, that is the biggest mistake today. And like I said in the beginning of this podcast, if you haven't started testing for resistant parasites in your horses, now is a very good time to start.
Mm-hmm. So what would the consequences look like if all of the available equine dewormers on the market failed due to resistance?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And we have some examples of that. I have farms that I have been working with and advising over now many years, where that is exactly the situation where we have Ascaris parasites resistant to all three classes of dewormers. We have small strongyles resistant to all three classes of dewormers. And we have tapeworms resistant to both classes of tapeworm dewormers. There's only two different kinds there. Mm-hmm. And so nothing really works. Now, one of the farms that where this is the case is a very successful thoroughbred farm. No names mentioned, but one that really is doing really, really well. Well, I should say. And the yearlings look great at the sales and they have excellent management. And so they just have a lot of parasites and they just have very high egg count when we test them, especially the yearlings. So, you know, so management, good management to a large extent can compensate for any negative effects of parasitism. So I think that's a good message. This particular operation is one that has plenty of acreage, which, you know, is a luxury of theirs that they can do things with that. They can, you know, use the paddocks, pastures and paddocks wisely and maybe, you know, shovel them up a little bit, you know, not use the same yearling paddock and pasture that they've used for the past 10 years and use a different area of grazing for the young animals. And that actually has an, you know, a substantial impact on egg count levels in the groups that are turned out to these new pastures or pastures that were grazed by adult horses in previous years instead of by young horses. I mean, the young horses are shedding much higher numbers of eggs than adults do, right? So that, like, returning to good old husbandry measures such as pasture rotation and pasture management is something that, you know, we should do more and that we now have an opportunity to revisit. Now, we also see that when we have drug resistance, interestingly and importantly, we often still have some reduction of egg counts following deworming. It's not like it goes to zero, or not necessarily, at least. It depends a little bit on the type of parasite and also which dewormer we talk about. But in general, we still see reductions, just not up near where it used to be and where it should be, but still some reduction. We might have 60% reduction instead of 95 or something like that. And the question is there still a benefit to reducing that burden at least partially for a period of time? Maybe there is for that individual horse. I mean, that's still a substantial reduction. I mean, the parasites are probably going to come back, but they always do, but it's a matter of managing the numbers. And So there's maybe still a place for even a partially effective dewormer, but it's important to still monitor the efficacy of those treatments. And then I think, you know, most interestingly is that for the most part, we still don't see parasitic disease on these farms. And like I said, they're high-end farms. They're very well managed. And so circumstances could be different elsewhere where people just don't have that kind of management and acreage and pasture quality and these other things that they can offer these horses. And that's maybe where, you know, this could turn into a problem. And of course, the sort of scary scenario is that we end up with a horse that could really benefit from an effective dewormer treatment.
Yes.
And then we just don't have one that we can offer to that horse. And now, parasitic disease is the exception, not the rule. And so, therefore, it doesn't mean that just because we have drug-resistant parasites all over the place, and we do, it doesn't mean that horses will all of a sudden develop a lot of health problems just because the parasites are now drug-resistant. They're not more pathogenic just because they're resistant. They're just the same parasites. The difference is that they don't disappear as easily, but they don't necessarily cause more disease than before. And I think that's an important point too.
Okay, thank you. So I'm going to move into some chatting about what's on the horizon. So could you describe any new or emerging technology on the horizon about parasitism beyond fecal egg counts that could improve how we detect and manage parasites?
Yeah, I think in recent years, most probably interesting development has been the so-called NEMA biome. Now, people may have heard about the microbiome, which is molecular methodology to map what bacteria species that might be living, for example, in the intestinal tract of a horse. And then you can map that an entire biome, which is like a lot of different bacterial families, and you can try to understand what they might do and how they might affect the horse, maybe positively or negatively, and things like that. Now, some colleagues of mine in Canada have developed or taken that same approach to to map out the parasites present in the intestinal tract. And that's particularly interesting for the horse because horses have more different species of parasites than any other domestic animal living in its intestinal tract. And that's just interesting. We don't know why, but that's puzzling. Why do they have so many more different species? And we don't know what those species actually do. When we talk about the small strongyles that we've been talking about today, there's actually about 40, actually more than 40 different species we found out now. 40 different species. Horses easily can have 20 of those at the same time. And so we've talked about them as the small strongyles, and the small strongyles do this and they do that, and then they develop resistance to this drug and that drug. But actually there's all these different species and they're not all alike. And we just haven't had the tool to really learn about them and know, you know, how they act together or individually, how they affect the horse, how they might some species be more prone to developing resistance than others. Do they all behave the same on pasture? Are some of them more tolerant to certain climate conditions than others? Well, we don't know because we haven't had the tool. Now we have the tool. And that enables us to really start learning a lot more about the biology of this whole group of parasites that, as I said, all horses have, and in some countries or some parts of the world, is still a cause of serious disease. Mm-hmm. And we want to understand why there are those differences and why, for example, we don't see those problems to the same extent in the U.S., for example. Do we have different species? We don't know, right? Yeah. And so as a research tool, first and foremost, at least at this point, this is a very intriguing tool because it will allow us to really learn things that we weren't able to learn before. And then with time, that can mount to us going, oh, this particular species or maybe this handful of species, when they occur together, we need to do this, or we should be aware of that, or we should make, you know, take this. I mean, so there might be some value to eventually with time testing for some of these particular individual species instead of just looking at strongyleics and not knowing what parasite species were you actually even dealing with. So I think as a horse owner, this is not something that they'll be exposed to right now. But I think maybe in 5 years' time or 10 years' time, it could be part of a testing panel where we've learned so much that we can say, well, it makes a difference whether we find fill in the blank or not.
Right.
So I think that's very interesting.
So that makes me think of when I was a kid, I was in 4-H and Pony Club, and in 4-H we had this competition called Hippology where you would go around and you would identify different types of forage and things like that. And there were these big jars of worms. And so if I was looking at a big jar of strongyles, I may have been looking at not just one species of strongyles, but five or six. So that kind of blows my mind.
Could be more. Absolutely. Yep. Yeah.
Wow. So you've spoken to briefly about practical prevention, the things like the rotation of the pastures. What are some other key management practices horse owners can use to reduce parasite burdens without relying solely on their dewormers?
I mean, there's always been the pasture hygiene. So picking up the poop is actually something that people do in some areas, depending on, you know, where you are, the climate, and sometimes also like how hilly the terrain is and how big is that paddock. But sometimes if the problem is that the stocking density tends to be a bit high here on this farm, and, you know, rotating the pastures or, you know, cross grazing with sheep and all, I mean, that's not realistic. I mean, you have a problem of overstocking, and then that could be really your only option is to clean up. And then that is very effective because if you've removed the poop and you do it frequently enough, then there won't be many parasite larvae on that pasture. But it requires some diligence for sure.
It does, for sure.
Yeah. And then, like I said, it not always practically feasible, but that's certainly something that can have an effect. And then, you know, it's interesting that some parts of the world there are these traditions for cross grazing with sheep and or cattle, and that is something that has been documented to actually have a you know, yeah, positive effect on parasitism, because they don't share, with few exceptions, they don't share the parasites. And then, for example, sheep tend to graze the areas that horses don't want to graze, and that also decreases the survival of those infective stages on pasture. So those are things that, you know, we don't see that frequently in the U.S., but in the U.K. and Ireland is very common, for example.
Indeed. So harrowing, I was wondering about harrowing and dragging. Would harrowing and dragging a pasture be enough if it were the right time of year, as far as just, you know, reducing the risk, or do you actually have to remove the poo?
No, I mean, so mowing, harrowing, and dragging would pretty much all have the same effect in terms of a parasite infectivity on that pasture. So what it does is that the dragging and the harrowing would be spreading out the fecal material. And by spreading it out, you remove a lot of that moisture and protection that the fecal matter actually provides to the parasitic larvae. They sort of kind of get protected inside of that poop. There might be a hard, dry shell on the outside, but then inside some moisture is retained, and that facilitates survival of those larvae for a longer time. And so by disrupting that, you decrease that survival, and therefore they die out more quickly. And when you mow, you cut the higher, taller grass, you cut that down, and from in those areas where horses tend to poop and not graze unless they're really forced to. And by doing that, because high grass retains moisture and it provides shade, and so by doing that, all of a sudden it dries out, and you don't have that shade, and therefore the same thing happens. The larvae and the eggs will die out more quickly. What it really depends on, big time, all of these three procedures, that the harrowing, the dragging, and the mowing, it really depends largely on what climate you have, right, and then when, what time of year you do it. And that differs so much between different parts of the world. And so, for example, in central Kentucky, where you are, the hot summer in August and July would typically be a very good time to do this, because it reaches, you know, 90 Fahrenheit, 95, sometimes over 100. And that's, you know, approaching 40 Celsius to those that don't know Fahrenheit. That's very hot, right? The eggs and the larvae don't survive temperatures above 40 Celsius. That's 104 Fahrenheit for more than a couple of days. So then they just die out. And so, and especially if they are left unprotected, so no tall grass with moisture, no intact fecal balls to protect them. And so that can be very effective in July and or August in Kentucky. Now, in Denmark, the weather right now is 70 Fahrenheit. It's been raining today. It'll take a very long time for those larvae to die out, even after you do this. And it won't be a matter of just maybe 3-4 weeks like in Kentucky. It would be maybe months, right? And if you do it even later in the year, in the fall, where temperatures drop even further and it rains even more, who knows how long it takes for those larvae to die out. So it really depends on the climate, but also the time of year. There's also been one study, and it's just one study, and it's an old study, but was done in the state of New York, where it gets very cold in the winter, like it actually does in many parts of the states. You get freezing temperatures and you get snow cover and really cold weather upstate New York. And they demonstrated that if you chain harrow prior to that first frost, but right prior, like end of the grazing season, but you drag that pasture and then you left it, the survival of Sturgeon parasites was substantially less following that winter.
Okay.
For all the same reasons, right? Now you didn't have the fecal piles to protect the eggs and the larvae against the temperature influence, like the freezing temperatures. You didn't have that insulating layer. The snow would help insulate, but before the snow cover came, a lot of larvae would die from the frost. So that apparently, based on that single study, suggests at least that there could also be a value of doing that sort of as an end of season thing. But again, it differs between different parts of the world.
Winterizing your pasture to prevent parasites in the spring. So, yeah. So what about parasite control plans as far as deworming? How often should vets revisit and update their plans for their clients? Is there a seasonal component to that too, or a risk-based strategy that makes the most sense?
I mean, Ascarids, we go by the age of the foals and mm-hmm. or weanlings, yearlings. So that's, and if you read the AAP guidelines, you'll see those sort of that framework. And then as you get to the strongyles and the tapeworms, it is very much a seasonal thing. We look at the season and when is the temperature warm enough for those to develop into infective stages. Mm-hmm. And that's the season of transmission. And we try to center our treatments around when that happens. And so that is different in North Dakota compared to Kentucky, compared to Florida, as a few examples. And we actually, in the AAP guidelines, we have included some prediction maps for those exact states that I just mentioned as examples to sort of demonstrate where that season is. And maybe you live in a state where you can go, oh, we're kind of like North Dakota here. So maybe we look more like that than we do Kentucky. But look at where that transmission season is and what months are we talking about, and then try to be strategic relative to when that happens and go, okay, the samples need to be collected around this time, and also the treatments have to happen during this period of time for them to be meaningful, because we're trying to reduce the parasite transmission. And so if we treat in the winter, we're really not doing anything because there's no okay. parasite transmission. So taking a look at, well, we can take a look at the AAP guidelines. They're actually open to everyone. You don't have to be a veterinarian or a member of AAP. Just go to the mm-hmm. website and you download that. There's a handful of charts representing different types of climates in different states. So there's also the hot and dry climate versus the hot and wet and those kinds of things.
That's great.
Take a look at that. Yeah.
I will link to the, in the show notes, I will link to the AAP guidelines as well as some like little things that we have done on thehorse.com to help people understand what they're supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we may have covered this a little bit in the question about technology and the biomes of the worms, but as an innovator in this area of equine research, what do you predict is next for parasite research?
Yeah, I think the direction that I'm going myself is to try and understand the interaction between different organisms that all live and hang out in the intestinal tract of the horse mm-hmm. and try to understand how they interact with each other. So, for example, the bacteria and the parasites. And there's also viruses that live in the intestinal tract and in the normal intestinal tract of the healthy horse. And there's funguses and other organisms as well. And there's been so little work done to really understand how these are actually affecting each other. And is there like a healthy, for example, healthy microbiome that might help keep the parasites at bay? And how do the parasites affect the bacteria? For example, nobody knows. Right? And so I think sort of learning how to understand that, and there's a number of ways you can maintain a healthy microbiome just through feeding and et cetera, just like we try to eat the right things and think about our microbiome. Same thing for the horses. And there's been a lot of work on that, but very, very little that sort of have evaluated how parasites might be affected. And that's something that I'm curious about. If I think it might hold some clues for why is it that we only rarely see parasitic disease and what are the conditions or the circumstances that occur when it happens in a horse, you know, because mm-hmm. we were like always sort of just throwing our hands a little bit in the air and go, oh, that was an unfortunate circumstance. This horse developed disease. Most often they don't, but this one did, and that was unfortunate, right? And so we really can't point our fingers very often to what exactly happened in this horse, because it's the same parasites that the next horse has,
right,
and the next one over. And so that's a direction that I'm going, at least, that I think is interesting and exciting and sort of broadening out the perspective instead of just looking at the worms. which I've done for 20 years.
Yes, it's a lot of time to spend with just the worms. So that's exciting, looking at the individuality of the how these animals are affected. So what gives you the most optimism when it comes to the future of equine parasite control? And do you think we're keeping pace with the challenges of resistance?
I mean, the optimistic me is, I think it's great to see all the effort around the world in having been made into developing good, solid, evidence-based recommendations for parasite control. And I think, you know, we've just published a paper where we compared all the guidelines and looked at the consensus and concluded that, you know, we agree, we say the same things. There are some differences, but those are understandable and logical when you know the conditions are, you know, that are different between the countries. So I think a lot of consensus there, which I feel we didn't have in the past. It used to be, you know, whenever I ask about advice for parasite control, and whenever I ask a new person, I get a different answer. Now I think we've certainly made some great effort in the right direction there. I think I'm very optimistic about that. I also would like to believe that should we ever get a new dewormer, you know, for equine parasites introduced, that we would know how to use it wisely and not overuse it. I think we are in a position to, you know, have learned from the past and know what not to do. So I think so that's a position of strength. We'll see how it's going to act, how it's going to pan out, when or if it happens. But I think we've certainly learned a lot. And so I think that's very optimistic. I also think we've developed some very good diagnostic tools in recent years. There's been a lot of emphasis on that, not just my group, but also other groups. I think we're much better off there now than we were just 10 years ago.
All right. Thank you. Well, that wraps up our conversation today. Thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Nielsen.
You are so welcome. It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Nielsen's message rings clear. Internal parasite control in horses demands strategy. Deworming without evidence builds resistance. Testing, timing, and targeted treatment help preserve deworming drug efficacy and protect our horses' health long-term.